Why won't President Trump release the Epstein files? Why did Britain just sign a new military alliance with Germany? What is Israel doing in Syria? And how have Chinese software engineers infiltrated the Department of Defense? We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. As I look over the news just about every day this week, it seems like the big story is the Epstein files and the Trump administration's failure to disclose more details, more information there. For our first story, we'll go to our US correspondent, Andrew Miller. Andrew, what is the truth about the Epstein files?
Yeah, well, this is definitely a big topic, something that probably the biggest thing I've seen since the Big Beautiful Bill that's actually turning Donald Trump supporters against him. He's done really what's can only be described as kind of like a U-turn on his position on the Epstein files, because during his first administration and then even more so on the campaign trail, he definitely talked about them a lot. His son Donald Trump Jr. talked about them a lot and about how much corruption it was in Washington, and made a campaign promise to release these files. And so now that he's been in office for a couple months, numerous people in America who were waiting for the release of these files and were really taken off guard with kind of came just out of the blue announcement a few days ago, where he came in and said that the client list doesn't exist. My supporters have been duped by another Democratic hoax perpetrated by Barack Obama. And he's like, and anyone who like turns against me because of this, I don't even want your support. So a lot to unpack here. And I think the best thing to do, just because since this is a topic with so many viewpoints and even a number of conspiracies mixed into it, is to just go back to the beginning and summarize what we know for sure. What we know for sure is there was a wealthy Wall Street financier named Jeffrey Epstein, who was arrested about 20 years ago in 2005 for sexually molesting a 14-year-old girl. He pled guilty to those charges and spent time in prison for them. He was released, went back to his old Wall Street finance networks, and then was arrested again, maybe a little over 10 years ago. This time, not for molesting somebody, but for actually trafficking underage girls for other people to molest. He pled not guilty to those charges and died in jail before it went to trial. Whether he killed himself or was murdered is the topic of much speculation. After that, his girlfriend and accomplice, Miss Maxwell, was also arrested on sex trafficking charges and is still alive and in jail to this day. Interestingly, despite the fact that two people were arrested for sex trafficking, none of the clients have been charged, because obviously trafficking requires both a seller and a buyer. So no client has been charged, which has made this a topic that a lot of Americans want to know about. It's like, well, who was he selling these people to? Because both former U.S. President Bill Clinton and the King of England's brother, Prince Andrew, have been accused, not charged, but accused of being with underage girls with Jeffrey Epstein. So these are both some high profile names have been thrown out there, names that would create huge domestic and international incidents if they were actually charged with something. And so it makes this a hot button topic that President Trump, up until recently, was saying that he wanted to release these files and get to the bottom of this. Now, after President Trump was reelected, his Attorney General Pam Bondi made an announcement that the Epstein client list was on her desk and she was getting ready to release it. And then things drug on for a while and people were wondering what was taking so long. So the undercover journalist James O'Keefe actually sent one of his undercover reporters to talk to Bondi, get some video footage. And that video footage, Pam Bondi had said that the government is actually in possession of thousands of hours of video footage showing, proving that Jeffrey Epstein was trafficking underage girls. But it took, was going to take the FBI and the Justice Department some time to comb through all this video footage before things could be released or convictions could be made. Because you need to protect the victims and make sure that the government even knows what all it has before they proceed with this. And that's about where we were at when President Trump very abruptly came out and said that Jeffrey Epstein definitely killed himself in jail. There is no clients list. This is all a hoax perpetrated by the Democrats. And so needless to say, a lot of people in America, both conservative and Democrats, aren't buying that explanation. If it was all a hoax perpetrated by the Democrats, then what was Pam Bondi even talking about when she said the files were on her desk, or when she told the undercover reporter that there's thousands of hours of video footage? What was Trump talking about on the campaign trail when he said this needs to be released? And so it's all, we don't know exactly all what's going on now. Now, Trump said it was another Russiagate hoax. And if you remember back to the Russiagate hoax, one of the big parts of the Steele dossier was falsely accusing President Trump of relations with prostitutes in Russia. And so we don't know if that's what he's talking about, because we did have a new wrinkle emerge just last night where the Wall Street Journal published a salacious letter that allegedly Donald Trump had given to Epstein for his 50th birthday, which his 50th birthday would have occurred 2 years before he was charged with molesting the 14-year-old back in 2005. So even if Donald Trump did give him this card, it was before he was publicly known to be a sexual deviant. However, like, the cards kind of got like this whimsical playwright style of writing that sounds nothing like Donald Trump. That's not usually the way he talks. And Donald Trump's come out and said he definitely did not write the letter and is suing the Wall Street Journal for publishing it. And so now we're looking at the possibility. I mean, this is at least what Trump's claiming, is that since these Epstein files were in possession of the Justice Department back when that Justice Department was run by Barack Obama and Joe Biden, that he's claiming that some of his political enemies may have planted information in the Epstein files that wasn't originally in there and that is not accurate, that actually would make a lot of sense if these files are implicating powerful people in U.S. politics, and they don't want, who don't want them to be released, is to like maybe put some fake information about the guy who wants to release them in there. At least that's what Trump's claiming right now, is that like, so there's fake information in the Epstein files, and I actually do find that possibility pretty believable, looking at the extent that the government went to undermine the Trump administration during the Russiagate hoax, that they could have planted some fake information in the Epstein files. However, at the same time, it seems like as soon as Donald Trump found out that there's some information in the files that could hurt him politically. He did a 180 turn, and is trying to dismiss the whole thing as a complete hoax, which obviously the entire thing is not a complete hoax made up by Barack Obama, because, like I said, Ghislaine Maxwell is still in jail for sex trafficking. We haven't apologized to her and let her out and said she's innocent, because she's not. So you're she was trafficking people to somebody. So there are clients out there who have never been charged. I think even Elon Musk made that statement, that he's like even just like one or two high profile convictions in this case would go a long way in assuring the American people that there's not this huge cover up. And I think in your Trumpet Morning Brief yesterday, you quoted General Michael Flynn, who was very politely trying to remind President Trump that this story is bigger than just what is politically expedient for him, even if there were some fake information planted in there. The story is really about protecting children, and there's the charges are like at least 200 were trafficked, and saying that it's great that they arrested the two people that we know were involved in the trafficking. But the clients list is the other big part of this story that we figures like, so if there are powerful people in Congress or in business, and Epstein did kind of specialize in catering to the well-connected, that's things that there needs to be convictions made. And even if they don't release the whole thing, there needs to be the American people need to be informed about what's going on. We'll see. I think today Donald Trump, he did, after the Wall Street Journal published their salacious letter, said that he is going to unseal some grand jury documents about Jeffrey Epstein. Now, his announcement said that this scam needs to go away, so I'm going to be unsealing some documents to just kind of put this to rest. And so the announcement definitely didn't sound like it was being made by someone to get who wants to get to the bottom of this. It definitely made it sound like someone who wants this whole thing to just go away as quickly as possible. So big story we're keeping our eye on. Like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if this is kind of another Russiagate style attack on Trump, in terms of like this letter that the Wall Street Journal published actually being completely made up. But at the same time, too, like two people were convicted for sex trafficking. There are clients out there. The fact that the sex trafficking operation happened is not a hoax. That's confirmable fact. And so you can't for political expediency just sweep this whole thing under the rug and not try to hold anyone to account for the crimes that were actually committed.
And I think this idea that maybe President Trump was inserted into the Epstein files, that's I heard that from Glenn Beck as well. And it does seem to be about the most plausible explanation I've heard for this U-turn. And his point of like it being a hoax, in that they have just been sitting around for so long. We've seen a lot of corruption within the Department of Justice, within the intelligence communities. What have they been able to do to get in there? I think that really is interesting to think about. But as I understand it, this is something you've been kind of doing some research on. I think we'll have something from Mr. Stephen Flurry in the next Trumpet print. At least that's the plan at the moment, right?
Yeah, there's a plan at the moment that he did. Mr. Stephen Flurry did his Trumpet Daily Radio show on the Epstein hoax yesterday. So we're looking through that, because the last article he wrote on this was back before Trump was in office. And it was titled like the or something to the factor is that like the scandal's far bigger than Epstein. Showing that there's definitely a lot of focus on Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking activities, as there should be. But it's also true that sex trafficking is probably the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the United States. There was, let me see if I've got. Yeah, there was actually the head of an elite Washington, D.C. preschool who was just arrested on sex trafficking charges in an FBI sting a couple weeks ago. So there's all these Washington elites sending their kids to this preschool, and the guy running it is a pervert. And you can find story after story after story, even tying into the border crisis. They're saying that the number of migrant children who the FBI's been who has actually rescued from sex trafficking rings has tripled since Joe Biden opened the border, just because we're getting to a point now where human trafficking's equally big to drug trafficking business for the drug cartels. And so they're just bringing in thousands of children from Latin America into the United States, being sold for sex. And then that's another one where, like the Epstein files, is that like there've been children rescued, there've been drug cartels taken down, but the clients always have a way of remaining conspicuously anonymous. It's like, okay, well, we know who's selling them, but who's buying them? And so between the drug cartels bringing in, like I said, immigrant children for sex trafficking, the guy running the preschool in Washington, D.C., the Epstein files, there's like a rap artist, P. Diddy, I think is, I don't think that's his birth name, but what he went by, who was involved in a very similar style sex trafficking ring to Jeffrey Epstein. So this is a nationwide problem that when you look at deserves a lot more attention. We actually even did an infographic in the Trumpet a number of years ago titled something to the effect of like the ripple effects of pornography that highlighted how actually even the line between like legal pornography and illegal pornography is very blurry. And so a lot of these people from Latin America and otherwise trafficked into the nation even end up in that vile industry, which actually showing how much bigger this problem is than Epstein is that. Oh, I think it's, I don't have the statistics on the top of my head, but I think it's somewhere around 70% of Americans regularly view pornography. It'd be higher for men and a little, maybe a little lower for women, but a super majority, like two-thirds. And so, which actually creates this ecosystem where supply and demand creating a need for some of the sex trafficking coming in from Latin America. So it's completely possible that like even some of the MAGA conservatives who are burning their red hats right now and are so angry at Donald Trump for not releasing the Epstein files are part of the problem. And just the fact that like if any of those people who are mad at Donald Trump for this are pornography viewers, and some of them undoubtedly are, then you might not be in a pedophile yourself or involved in sex trafficking yourself, but you're creating this ecosystem that creates men like Jeffrey Epstein. While Isaiah talks about like the whole head being sick, that it's not just one corrupt Wall Street financier and then a couple high-ranking politicians, but just the sexual perversion in American society that creates men like this is extremely widespread.
And that's something that needs to be exposed, and solving a lot of the problems within the United States starts with exposing it. And Mr. Flurry even pointed back to the Old Testament and about how some of these kings, Solomon, but there's a great many others that when they came in and those that made Israel great again or made Judah great again started by clearing out all of the filth and evil that had been going on before them. There's been part of me that's a little frustrated trying to write the morning brief every day and kind of keeping on having to talk about Jeffrey Epstein because I don't have any more information than is out there to give people. And so it just kind of feels like, well, I can't give you any more. I can't tell you anything about this. I don't know the truth of these items any more than you do. So yeah, it's been frustrating in that regard. But this is an important story. And it is about, is America going to confront and expose and repent from the evil that has come before? And you know, just because it's exposed, that doesn't mean that the nation will repent, especially in the way that you pointed out. You know, this is broader than just, okay, I'm not an elite who sex trafficked some women or some young girls. This is about sins that are sadly common in the United States that also feed into this same problem. So, you know, just because they're exposed, repentance is a step beyond that, but we're not going to get there if these sins aren't exposed. So it's an important story for America, for turning America around, for making America great again. And maybe, as you say there, we will have some more details released from this, as perhaps there is a bit of a change in heart, maybe from President Trump. What other stories do you have for us from the Anglo-America region?
Yeah, I've got another actually kind of related one on the moral front is Chip and Joanna Gaines. They're two television stars here in America, famous for their series Fixer Upper, buying old houses and fixing them up. So a lot of people watch them for that. Are actually now producers of a new show featuring a same-sex couple raising surrogate sons. So another example of normalizing sexual perversion in America. And something I normally wouldn't bring up just because there's so many shows like this in America today. The media has just really doubled down on woke culture. But Chip and Joanna Gaines are pretty outspoken Christians in America too. In their Fixer Upper show, they've definitely tried to emphasize their Christian roots. And so the fact that like even these two professed Christian personalities are now doing a show trying to normalize same-sex marriage and same-sex adoption definitely shows the moral decline, not just in America, but even amongst the religious people in America. They've made some profile comments about how Christians shouldn't judge other people. And so they want to do this show in an attempt to even get like the Christian community to accept homosexual marriage, homosexual adoption, which is actually something that the statistics overwhelmingly show, that like amongst those adopted by a homosexual couple, they're more likely to be sexually abused than just about anyone else. And so just another story just showing how deep the moral rot in America goes. I guess another family morality story is New York's gone so radical that they're looking at electing a Muslim socialist as their mayor this October. I guess we'll see whether that happens. But the socialist mayor candidate, Zohran Mamdani, he was making statements, and he's very anti-police, saying that police shouldn't be making domestic violence calls anymore. He feels like psychologists should be the ones to handle cases where women or children or men, could be anyone in the family, are beaten in a domestic violence case by someone in their family, which is another story. Getting back to like the sexual abuse angle we've been talking about, but also just showing this socialist mayor candidate is also a Muslim, which is a religion that is also statistically high, more higher than likely to have domestic violence problems just because of their radical views on women. And so having him coming up here saying that, like, well, the police shouldn't even be looking into these type of things anymore. Another really big story that anyone who lives in New York or in America for that case should be concerned about. And then finally, one other story that might give us maybe just a bit of an inkling of good news is the Supreme Court has handed Donald Trump one of his biggest victories, saying that he may proceed to lay off half the people working for the Department of Education. That's something Donald Trump wanted to do, and then the courts were trying to block, and they're going to let him go ahead with it. But again, that's another institution that, like, when you look at the grants that the Department of Education writes, its purpose is largely to bribe states into teaching sexual perversion. You'll have a school in a state that wants to teach that homosexuality is normal or that transgenderism is normal, and maybe that state won't want to teach that. And then the Department of Education, they'll say, it's like, well, if you don't teach that, then you won't get any federal grant money. And they try to strong arm them with the grant money into teaching the sexual perversions that the American deep state wants taught. And so Donald Trump, he's been talking about completely abolishing it. And so now with this new Supreme Court decision, it looks like he's going to lay off at least half the people who work there, which should be an absolute win for in terms of at least downsizing the government's power to spread immorality by force.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Last week, I talked about a new deal that Britain and France had regarding their nuclear weapons. This week, we saw the UK sign a new treaty with Germany. Here are the two leaders talking to the media after the signing.
Friedrich, it's such a pleasure to welcome you here to Downing Street, particularly since we've just signed the Kensington Treaty in the last hour, which is a historic document. Which really measures just how close our countries are and our ambition for the future. I can't actually believe that it's the first German-UK treaty of its sort ever.
So, as you heard there, a pretty significant moment for British-German relations. It's an attempt to kind of reset things after Brexit, an attempt to bring Britain back into the heart of Europe after Brexit. It's going to cover travel, it's going to cover fighting illegal migration together, fighting cross-border crime. There's economic aspects of it, but the most important part of this, the heart of this, is a defense agreement. They're going to work together militarily, and then the most notable part of this is a promise to assist one another, including by military means, in case of an armed attack on the other. So, a mutual defense clause. If you're attacked, I promise to defend you, and vice versa. And what's interesting about this is, at first glance, this seems pointless because Germany and Britain are both part of NATO, and NATO already says an attack on one country will be an attack on all. So if anyone attacks Germany, Britain is already obligated to come to Germany's defense, and vice versa. Why the need for this? And I think that points to the entire purpose of this treaty, of the talks with France last week. This is all about replacing NATO. And it's about Europe's defense after America pulls out, or an alternative to America. The whole point of NATO originally, in the famous words of its first Secretary General, Lord Hastings Ismay, was to keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And the idea was that Germany wouldn't have an independent military, they would be part of the NATO establishment. But here, Britain is helping Germany sign their own deals that are kind of replacement to NATO or backup plans for NATO. I mean, Germany has gotten a lot out of NATO. They're still getting a lot out of NATO. NATO is, partly that is the big excuse for Germany boosting their defense spending. They're deploying their troops to Lithuania under the NATO flag, or NATO had a major role in that base getting started. So they're absolutely using NATO, and I think they're quite happy for NATO to continue for now. But at the same time, they're getting ready to stand on their own without America, and they're planning for ending their reliance on America. The Telegraph put it very well yesterday, where they pointed out that this is all about a triangle of London, Berlin, and Paris. They pointed out that this treaty says the parties shall seek to intensify the triangular cooperation with the French Republic and to jointly address international challenges. So it's right there in the treaty itself. We want to work with France. Friedrich Merz, while he was there in Britain, he said it was no coincidence that he was coming a week after the French President Emmanuel Macron. It's about building a three-way alliance. The Telegraph talked about the way it's a partnership of Europe's two nuclear powers with its richest nation, which has plans to build its strongest army. So that's kind of the picture that's building place. Germany supplies the big army, the manpower and the money, and then Britain and France put their nuclear weapons on the table and supply that to Germany. And you have then a replacement for America's defense umbrella. As this article points out, if there's no need for a NATO safety net, why replicate Article 5? It's clear that Berlin, London, and Paris don't want to be caught short by Washington again. So it's about replacing America. And just to get into some of the other details of the defense agreement, there are 17 projects in there. They're going to work together on the development of national biosecurity strategies. They're going to work together against state terrorism with biological agents. They're already working on a European deep precision strike system, something with a 1,500-ish mile range that can strike deep into enemy territory. They said they were going to work on like quantum technology, AI, semiconductors, lots of other things they're going to be working with. And of course, you have the Trinity House Agreement that Britain signed with Germany last year, where you have, for example, Rheinmetall making a new artillery factory or a gun barrel factory in the UK. And now, more recently, the German military startup Helsing is building another factory, a resilience factory, to work on AI capabilities within the UK. And they're going to produce hundreds of mini submarine drones in the UK that way. So you're having Britain become dependent on these German defense companies. And there's a great danger here. It's a similar point to what we made last week, that Britain and America, and Britain in particular here, is relying on Germany and relying on France and Europe for their defense. And they feel like they can't stand alone. Even Britain apparently feels like it doesn't want to or can't rely on the United States, and they're looking to Germany for help. And the Bible warns that that is a profound danger. And Mr. Armstrong, and then Mr. Flurry after him, warned for decades about Britain and America doing this, and forecast that Britain would do this. I mean, Mr. Armstrong was forecasting this after World War II, that we'd go back and we would rely on Germany. And he articulated very clear why God is against this. This is a clip from one of his messages.
Thou shalt love the eternal thy God with all your mind and heart and soul and strength. That's the first and great commandment. We violate that as a nation. Now, I don't think we realize we're doing it. I don't think we do at all. I think we sincerely think. We've just kidded ourselves into thinking, we've been deceived into believing that we're really relying on God. But then, you know, we think that God is sort of a myth and he's far off and maybe he's not real and maybe he couldn't really help us. So we must depend on something that is real. We must depend on something that we can see. And so now we're so afraid of Russia that the United States government feels that it must take what we call a calculated risk, you know, and try to build up Germany and Central Europe against Russia. All right, you'll see what we're building. And you're not going to have to wait more than 15 years to see it, and I don't think you'll wait that long.
And he talked about America building up Germany in Central Europe. Britain is doing the same thing, and we, you know, certainly Britain feels it would never feel like it could rely on God for its defense. And Mr. Armstrong said it's going to backfire. Here's another clip where he talked about that.
Says this, to our people of the United States. This is for us today, my friends. This is a prophecy. This is not some old, dead, and gone ancient history. This is a live, living prophecy, an energized prophecy under the inspiration of God Almighty, and it's for us, and this is the message of God. This is the Thus Saith the Eternal. All your allies have forgotten you. They care nothing for you, for I have dealt you the blow of an enemy. Our allies. All right. Your lovers, your allies, Germany and Japan, don't care anything for you, and they're going to forget us too. And God says, I have dealt you the blow of an enemy, the punishment, which is going to happen now in less than 25 years, the punishment of a merciless foe, because your guilt is great, because your sins are so flagrant.
You know, we rely on these countries. We think they're our lovers. We think they're going to keep us safe. And as Mr. Armstrong said, well, they don't care anything for us. And Mr. Flurry, of course, has talked about this a lot as well. And I'll read some quotes from him in just a second. But one thing I think is interesting with you look at what Mr. Flurry said about this is he very strongly has brought France into the equation. This is the introduction to A Key of David that he gave, where he's summarizing, it was like the third of three parts. But he's summarizing the message that he was giving on this front.
Greetings, everyone. Last week, I showed you how biblical Reuben is the father of modern-day France. And Reuben betrayed his brother Joseph anciently. And, of course, Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, which are Britain and America today. That is modern-day Joseph. So if we look at the end time, we can see that Reuben, or France, is going to betray America and Britain again in this end time.
So there's even prophecies in the Bible that show that France is going to betray Britain and America. And we can put a link to an article in our show notes that will talk more about that. And I think you see the way that France is helping to draw Britain into this three-way alliance. That's a big part of that. And like I said, Mr. Flurry has warned about this for years. He had an article 12, 13 years ago now called Germany is Betraying Britain Again. And he wrote, America and Britain have convinced themselves they have a wonderful friendship with the Germans. But is it true? If you see what happens to Britain, you know it's not true. And then he goes to Ezekiel 23. And verse 9, which is a passage full of symbolism. God in that passage explains the symbolism. You know, he talks about Ahola and Aholibah, Ahola representing modern Israel. And Ezekiel wrote his book after the northern tribes of Israel went into captivity. And in there, he makes very clear this distinction between the state of Judah, that Ezekiel was a citizen of, and Ezekiel went into captivity when Judah went into captivity, and there was still a remnant for most of the time that he was writing, living back in Judea. And then he's talking about the northern tribes of Israel, and they're distinct. And he's got this message for the northern tribes of Israel, and he was in captivity. The northern tribes of Israel were also in captivity somewhere else, and Ezekiel had no way of delivering that message. What was the point of Ezekiel getting a message for the northern tribes of Israel? The only explanation is that it's for the descendants, the modern descendants of those northern tribes of Israel, which, as Mr. Armstrong showed in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that refers to Britain and America. And so Ezekiel chapter 23 warns about, God says, I have delivered her, or Ahola, or basically America and Britain, I have delivered her into the hands of her lovers, into the hands of the Assyrians, or the Germans in biblical symbolism in Bible prophecy, upon whom she doted. They doted on the Germans, they helped them, they gave them nuclear bombs, protected them from the Soviet Union in America's case, and Britain to a smaller degree. And the Bible prophecy says they're going to be betrayed. And Mr. Flurry writes, in a small way, this has already happened to Britain. But you watch as this prophecy is fulfilled completely. It is about to get far, far worse. Watch for that to happen now with Britain's relationship with Germany. Hosea 5 is another passage, Hosea 5 and verse 13, another warning we quote on this subject quite often. It says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you, nor cure you of your wound? And in his book on Hosea, Mr. Flurry writes, Hosea prophesied that wounded Judah and sick Ephraim will go to Germany for help. Why? Because America is even sicker than both of them and can be of no help at that point. The deadly weakness of these three nations leads to their destruction by Germany at the same time. And I think you see this is playing out already. And yeah, there's some strength in the United States and somewhat of a resurgence. There's also a massive debt that means America's looking to cut its military obligations and kind of has to, otherwise it's going to go bankrupt. And so Britain, Judah in the Middle East, they feel like, well, they can't depend on America the way that they might in the past. You also have the deep political divisions, and that plays into that. And so, well, Britain is looking to Germany, and that is going to backfire horribly. But God is going to use that to correct Britain, to correct America, ultimately to bring the world to him. Here's one more quote from Mr. Armstrong talking about that hopeful conclusion.
You're living in terrifying times, and you probably don't realize it. You're just so interested in this apparent time of peace, and you like to get it out of your mind, and it's a time when we can have mechanical and material luxuries and gadgets and things, and we're so interested in those things. We're so self-centered in our own selves and other people and the things that our hands can make, in human interests and television, in the new kind of movies that are coming out, in everything to amuse and entertain ourselves. We don't realize how empty our lives are either. Hear the word of the Eternal, O you nations, declare it in the isles afar off, and say, he that scattered Israel, which means here, America and Britain, will gather him and keep him as a shepherd doth his flock. That scattering is yet to happen a second time. For the Eternal hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand that was stronger than he. Therefore, they shall come and sing in the height of Zion, and shall flow together to the goodness of the Eternal. That's after we've learned our lessons. For wheat, and for wine, and for oil, and for the young of the flock and of the herd, and their soul shall be as a watered garden, and they shall not sorrow any more at all. Then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance, or the young women, both young men and old together, for I will turn their mourning, which is coming on our people, I'm warning you, my friends. I, says God, finally, when we've learned our lesson, will turn their mourning into joy, and will comfort them and make them rejoice from their sorrow, and I will satiate the soul of the priests with fatness, and my people shall be satisfied with their goodness, saith the Eternal. So, my friends, there is the good news that is coming on beyond today's terrible bad news.
And you can read more about what God is doing here from our book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. Well, there are a lot of other European stories. I'll just try and run down quickly. The European Union has unveiled a massive $2 trillion budget for the next 5-6 years or so, 2028 to 2034. The previous budget was 1.2 trillion, now it's 2 trillion, so they're almost doubling it. The European Commission called it the most ambitious EU budget ever. And a lot of people are not happy with it. It's, I think, probably the most controversial EU budget ever as well. Germany is not happy. They said a comprehensive increase in the EU budget is not acceptable at a time when all member states are making considerable efforts to consolidate their national budgets. We will therefore be unable to accept the Commission's proposal. It gives the EU power to raise its own taxes, or more power to do that. I think they want taxes on tobacco companies, taxes on large European companies with turnovers of over 100 million. It also gives them a lot of discretionary funds that's not necessarily earmarked, which starts to give the EU more power. This would make the European Commission less dependent on German funds. And I'm sure as Europe moves towards a super state and the beast power prophesied in the Bible, it will have the power to tax and the freedom to spend money in the future. But at the moment, this kind of power of the purse is how Germany controls the European Commission for a large part and controls the EU. So until Germany has other levers of control more firmly established, then it seems unlikely that they're going to let Europe have this kind of unconstrained spending. But also, you've got Europe now fighting over its budget. And at the same time, France is also fighting over its budget, where the French Prime Minister François Bayrou, he unveiled a new plan to bring France's runaway spending under control. He aims to cut about $50 billion from France's budget. He sounded some powerful warnings. He said that France's debt was a mortal danger, warned that the nation was adding about 5,000 euros to its debt every second. And so he wants to reduce the civil service. He wants a one-time tax or solidarity contribution, as he calls it, on the rich, closing tax loopholes to kind of keep welfare benefits and tax income tax brackets the same and not raise them in line with inflation the way that they're typically raised. And then most controversially of all, he wants to cancel two national holidays. He wants to cancel Easter Monday and VE Day. That is massively controversial. I wonder whether he introduced that last part as a kind of strategic retreat, planning to backtrack on that to try and save some of his other measures. But you've got now France's parliament is massively divided between the far left and the far right and the middle, and they can't really agree on anything apart from the fact that they hate this new budget. This could bring down the French government potentially. It's certainly going to lock them up in months and months of negotiation. I mean, what you see is the European Commission as a whole locked up now in a big fight over its budget. France locked up in a big fight over its budget. All this political dysfunction is going to lead to the rise of a strong leader Europe. A Europe with 10 kings, a Europe with one overall strong leader, a Europe that looks very different to the EU that you see right now. Because their democracies and their committees are just not getting anything done and just getting locked up with endless strife and endless arguing as they go off the fiscal cliff. And this is kind of what happened during the French Revolution. You had French prime ministers and finance ministers then that couldn't get control of the budget until it all exploded. You had chaos, and then you had a strong man in the form of Napoleon Bonaparte. So we're watching for another strong leader. And there's other instances of chaos for the European Union this week. Belgium has become the latest EU country to bring back border checks, as the Schengen area, this free trade area, this fact that you could travel around Europe without passports is probably the most visible symbol of European success, European integration. That falling apart, that's a big deal for Europe. So another crisis for Europe. You also have one in Spain where the brother of the prime minister has fled to Japan after being indicted for embezzlement. Japan doesn't have an extradition treaty to Spain. More corruption there, more political chaos. Germany, you had a big argument about the appointment of a judge where the left wanted to put in quite an extremist far left judge. The right didn't follow through on their agreement to nominate or to kind of go along with whether the left nominated. That's caused a bunch of coalition chaos. It's all leading to the rise of a strongman. And then another thing that's causing Europe a lot of stress is this trade war with President Trump, where Donald Trump, just after we recorded, I think on Friday, sent Ursula von der Leyen a letter informing her that the EU is going to face substantially larger tariffs. Tariffs of 30% as the kind of the general default level starting on August 1st. Not the 10% level that the EU was hoping for. The only reason the European Union isn't completely freaking out about this right now is they believe in TACO, that Trump always chickens out, as the US media have coined it. But if he doesn't, this is going to be very hard for them. And that's another prompt for them to have this strong leader that can negotiate face-to-face with Donald Trump rather than all of these committees that can't agree on anything. And also it's going to prompt them to do deals with Europe, with Japan. They're already working hard on some different trade deals and rare earth deals with Japan, and the rise of this trading bloc called in the Bible the Mart of Nations that will shut the US out of world trade. Also in France's budget, there were cuts everywhere, but their military faced some substantial increases. They're going to raise the budget by 6.5 billion euros so that it reaches 64 billion euros. That's 75 billion US dollars by 2027. That's still short of Germany's budget at 86 billion. So Germany will retain that kind of crown as Europe's biggest defense spender. But Emmanuel Macron said, to be free in this world, we must be feared. To be feared, we must be powerful. So Europe continuing to step up and beef up their military as they work to become an independent power to the United States. And then finally, some big stories from the UK. We had a massive scandal here this week where the British government paid about £7 billion to bring in, it's probably going to end up being about 100,000 migrants, lied about it and made it illegal for anyone to report on the story. This looks set to be one of the biggest scandals in modern British history, where someone at the Defense Department leaked the identity of 24,000 Afghans who claimed to have helped British forces during the Afghan invasion. It seems like about 15 out of 16 of them were lying just as an excuse to come to Britain. But because their names were on this list, the worry was that these people would be targeted by the Taliban. So they airlifted many of them in the UK. Then a lot of them gained the right to bring in family members. So, and of course, for many of these men, they have multiple wives. So you're looking at closer to 100,000 Afghans being brought to the UK by the time all is said and done. And then the government applied to a super injunction that made it illegal for the press to report about it and illegal to report that anything was being covered up. The High Court lifted that super injunction yesterday, allowing this story to be, or not yesterday, I think it was Tuesday, but allowing the story to be revealed for the first time. It's the first time the UK government has ever taken out a super injunction. So bringing in massive migration, covering it up, lying about it, that's what we've seen from this British government repeatedly on immigration. It's causing a migrant crisis and completely destroying trust between British citizens and the UK government. But the Labour government have a solution and have a way to stay in power. They're going to let 16-year-olds vote at the next election. And young people, especially their teachers, tend to swing left. We've seen this in poll after poll after poll. This seems a pretty blatant attempt at from the Labour government to try and finagle the electorate to make it easier for them to stay in power. And this is the same government that is raising the age for young people to buy cigarettes, for young people to vape. They've supported raising the age of when people are allowed to use a sunbed, being tried as an adult, buying alcohol, even opening a bank account. They've all supported raising the age from 16 to 18 for these things. They're wanting to ban advertising to young people of junk food because they believe they're too easily influenced. And yet they're lowering the voting age. You know, not that I necessarily disagree with some of those other things that they've done, but the point is, it's naked hypocrisy. It suits them, so they're fiddling with the election. But it also, or the electorate, and it also reminds me of Isaiah chapter 3 that talks about, well, babes shall rule over you. They're lowering the age because young people, influenced by their left-wing teachers, are more likely to vote them back into power. Now, also, support for reform upon this age group from this age group is quite strong. It might backfire, but you know, more political shenanigans from the UK. So a whole lot of big stories going on in Europe. But of course, there's always a lot going on in the Middle East. And to hear about that, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mohaid Ozeki.
On Sunday, clashes erupted between Druze and Bedouin militias in Syria. This apparently was instigated when a Druze vegetable merchant in the city of Sweida, which is a Druze majority city in the south of Syria, was kidnapped by one of these gangs, by the Bedouin gangs. The Bedouin militias apparently have connections to the Syrian government, and so there has been violence escalating. Either way, the government in Damascus has been concerned, is claiming it's a neutral spectator to this and sending military over to calm the situation down. The Bedouin gangs are Islamists, and they have varying connections to the government there. So there's a lot of suspicion that they're just going in there to protect their buddies. There's been reports of extrajudicial killings. The Druze are, technically speaking, people consider them an offshoot of Shia Islam, but they're really their own religion, and they've been persecuted for a long, long time in the area that spread out between Syria, Israel, Lebanon, this Levantine area. And Israel has about 150,000 Druze in their population. Most of them are quite assimilated. They've even fought for Israel in the War of Independence in 1948. And they're understandably concerned about what's happening with their relatives, and in some cases, direct family members in Syria. There's a lot of Druze that live in the Golan Heights. That was a part of Syria within living memory. They still have connections there. And so Israel has reinforced its positions that it's occupying in southern Syria, and has famously on Wednesday did an airstrike in front of the Syrian Ministry of Defense as a warning shot. It's not just the Druze that they're going in to defend. The Israeli government has also said that they're hoping to negotiate a demilitarized buffer zone in southern Syria from the Syrian government, and that the Syrian government is sending soldiers in that intended buffer zone right now directly impedes that. The Syrian president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, has blamed Israel, but has also called for like a de-escalation of everything. He obviously just got into power months ago. He doesn't have complete consolidation over the country and is hoping to create a peace treaty with Israel, almost certainly as a way to legitimize his rule. We reported not that long ago on this program that Israel is in negotiations with Syria to normalize relations. And from what we can tell, the offers that Syria is making are the most favorable any government in Syria has ever made to Israel, recognizing the Golan Heights, this buffer zone that I've talked about, and that Israel is seriously toying with these agreements. But at the same time, Shiraz, we've talked about until recently, led a group that was an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. He's stalked many of those figures that helped him wage his jihadist war into the Syrian government. They are an Islamist government. This government, as I mentioned, it's still early days, is still trying to put everything together, but we're getting a lot of warning signs like this that they're not the friendly new pro-Western administration that a lot of people in governments like the United States in media would like to have us believe. And as we mentioned on this program several times, this relates to a particular biblical prophecy in Psalm 83, which talks about an alliance coming together, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. You look at the participants of this alliance, and neither in the Bible nor in secular history can you find these people ever coming together for that purpose or with each other specifically, which is why Mr. Gerald Fleury, our editor-in-chief, has pointed to this being a prophecy. And for our purposes, verse 6 mentions the Hagarenes, or the ancient inhabitants of Syria, being involved in this alliance. And Mr. Fleury has since talked about other countries like the Gulf Arabs, like Jordan, these more moderate so-called countries, many of which already have peace with Israel, as being a part of this alliance as well. And that Israel is going to be, because of these deals, because of these more friendly relations they have, Israel is going to be taken a bit off guard by when this alliance actually strikes it. And in Syria's case, you could see them coming closer and closer towards normalization. You could also see with how they're persecuting the Druze, more blatantly than even some of these other members of the alliance, they still hold true to their ideals. And therefore, the violence we've been seeing throughout the week is just another sign that the closer Israel gets to these countries, the closer it gets to walking into a trap.
I think the other angle on that story that really stands out is it does expose the truth of so much that is happening about the Middle East, where you've had all of these groups that are so quick to attack Israel and condemn Israel, and any time Hamas claims Israel hit a hospital, and then it subsequently turns out to be not true, and actually Hamas hits the hospital, and all of those kind of things. Those groups have said nothing about the attack on the Druze. I mean, that was true earlier in the week. I spent a few minutes looking around, could see nothing from Amnesty International on this attack against the Druze. Again, at least earlier in the week, there was nothing from Human Rights Watch on this. And you know, these are the groups that claim to be upholding protecting innocent lives. And instead, who is it that protects innocent lives? It's Israel. Israel is the one that responds with the warning shot, like you pointed out, and protects the Druze here. This is what Melanie Phillips wrote on her website on Thursday. She said, Israel went into Syria to defend them. No one else lifted a finger. The IDF launched dozens of airstrikes targeting Syrian government troops and convoys heading into Suweida, and today struck the Syrian Defense Ministry headquarters and sites near the presidential palace. And instead, all of these people, again, that claim that they're just there trying to protect innocent life, and when Israel actually does that, they then still turn around and condemn Israel. So the UN Secretary General, he said, I'm alarmed by continued escalations of violence in Syria and unequivocally condemn all violence against civilians. I condemn Israel's escalatory airstrikes and reports of the IDF's redeployment of forces in the Golan. Like him, so much of the English-speaking media presenting this as if Israel just hit Syria out of nowhere. Like everything was cut fine, nothing was happening, and then Israel comes in and just decides to start bombing Damascus. So very revealing, I think, where Israel's heart is, what they're doing, very revealing on the attack, the unhinged attack on Israel, the unhinged attack on Benjamin Netanyahu. That's just a very brief summary. If you'd like more, Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry hit this in Wednesday's Trumpet Daily Show, Rising Lion Strikes Again. So that's a great place to go and get more on this story. You had some... and we can make sure we put a link to that in our show notes. But you were about to go on and give us some other Middle Eastern stories.
Yes, so on Wednesday, chaos in the Knesset took place with United Torah Judaism, one of the coalition partners of Benjamin Netanyahu in the Israeli government, left the government and leaving Mr. Netanyahu with a majority of one in the Knesset. So this doesn't actually kick him out of office, but it puts him dangerously close, never mind even a no-confidence one, but just even passing basic legislation. The instigator of all this is United Torah Judaism, if you can guess from its name, is an Orthodox Jewish interest party. We've talked on this program before about the big crisis between conscripting Orthodox Jews into the IDF, like every other Jewish Israeli citizen. They've had an unofficial ban for decades. That ban was removed not that long ago. Mr. Netanyahu relies on parties like these to stay in power. At this point, UTJ just had enough and said, okay, we're done, we're out. The next day after that, another Orthodox interest party, Shas, said it would withdraw its ministers from the executive government, but will still stay within the coalition as far as the legislature is concerned. So if they were to leave, and a lot of people suspected they would have left, we could have seen early elections. That hasn't happened yet, and these two parties know that if early elections get called and the left gets into power, then they're almost certainly going to get their base being conscripted, so it's a bit of a lose-lose for them. So Mr. Netanyahu's safe politically now, but it's another headache for him in the middle of war. And also yesterday news broke that Gaza's only Catholic church sustained damage from an Israeli tank. We've gotten details so far that looks like it's accidental. The response from the Catholic Church has been very interesting. The Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, Pier Battista Pizzaballa, whom we've talked about in this program plenty of times before, has said that he wasn't sure it was accidental. Pizzaballa is implying that Israel would have went out of its way to attack a Catholic church, which, I mean, rings back to my ears, at least, to maybe some blood libels that Jews intentionally target Christians because they're Christians. That's obviously nonsense. He's said comments like this before the war even started, that the current government is encouraging persecution against Christian groups in Israel, even though it's probably the safest country in the Middle East to be a Christian. What is interesting also, I think, is that Israel made the public apology about hitting this that particular building after U.S. President Donald Trump phoned Netanyahu and pressured him to put out an apology. We obviously have a new pope, an American pope, in the Vatican right now, who President Trump has gotten off very warmly with, and this may very well be him trying to pressure Israel to give a bit more of a conciliatory tone to the Vatican. He's obviously had the meeting in St. Peter's Basilica with Zelensky. It looks like he's prioritizing good relations with the Vatican. And we've talked on this program before about how the U.S. and Israel and other countries trusting the Vatican, accepting them more and more as a peacemaker, as somebody to work together with, is going to backfire.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. Now, Chinese software engineers may have infiltrated the heart of the Department of Defense, but not through being particularly sneaky, but by being invited in there by Microsoft. To tell us more about this shocking story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. China has computer engineers embedded inside the U.S. Defense Department's computer systems, and America is paying for them to be there. This is according to a ProPublica investigation that was published Tuesday, and the findings of this investigation are really chilling. It all centers on Microsoft, as you said, which has been working with the U.S. Department of Defense for decades, and Microsoft's business model relies partly on top-tier engineers working inside of China. That's a very alarming revelation to, you know, have Chinese engineers helping to maintain computer systems that America relies on for all, you know, all manner of aspects of national defense. Very chilling to hear that. Now, Microsoft does say that they have a barrier against sabotage and spying, which is a team of American citizens who have security clearance. They call these digital escorts, and they're supposed to supervise the work of these foreign computer engineers. So that might sound somewhat reassuring, but the trouble is that the digital escorts are generally former military personnel who have little or no coding expertise. So these Americans are ill-equipped to really be able to police the work of the Chinese engineers and coders. One of the Americans spoke to ProPublica about this arrangement, and he said, quote, "We're trusting that what the Chinese engineers are doing is not malicious, but we can't really tell," end quote. They can't tell because the Americans just don't know. They don't have the expertise to really know what the Chinese engineers are doing. Matthew Erickson is a former Microsoft employee who worked with this escort program, and he gave ProPublica an example just showing how easy it might be for the Chinese to really dupe those digital escorts that they have. He said, quote, "If someone ran a script called fix_servers.sh, but it actually did something malicious, then the American escorts would have no idea," end quote. So this new report is very alarming. It's especially alarming because China was recently designated by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence as, quote, "the most active and persistent cyber threat to U.S. government, private sector, and critical infrastructure networks," end quote. And evidence proving the accuracy of that designation has been abundant. You know, in recent years, there have been several major hacks by Chinese operatives compromising some extremely sensitive U.S. systems in various ways. But some cyber experts now believe that Microsoft's decision to use Chinese engineers to help run the Department of Defense's systems is the worst one yet. They believe that it poses an even greater threat to America's national security than these past infiltrations. So it's a very unsettling development, but for those who follow the trumpet, this sort of thing really should have been expected, because trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has been warning for years about the danger of America's dependence on computer systems, especially in the military realm. Even as early as the mid-1990s, Mr. Fleury was sounding the alarm about this, and he said that the threat reminded him of a passage in Ezekiel chapter 7. This passage describes a future time when God will punish America for its refusal to turn to him. And verse 14 describes one specific aspect of that punishment. It says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle, for my wrath is upon all the multitude thereof." Mr. Fleury said that this is about a future time when U.S. military technology will have been infiltrated and compromised by enemies, and it prevents the U.S. from really even responding and mobilizing. And you can see how that could very easily be the case if we are paying Chinese engineers to work on our DoD systems. So it's very sobering to consider the full potential of these kinds of attacks. And for anyone who would like to see the significance of this in the context of Bible prophecy, we have an article called "China Hacks America and None Goes to Battle" that goes into a lot of detail about the various Bible passages on this topic.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Just a really revealing story on how much America has been infiltrated, but also just how careless the United States has been. I think in some ways that's one of the most disturbing parts of this story, and so many others that we see, that America just doesn't, and Britain too, and we just don't take seriously the idea that we live in a dangerous world, and we kind of just assume everyone's going to play nice, everyone's going to play by the rules, no one would do anything underhand. I mean, you see this in the UK story that I was talking about. We're happy to sign mutual defense deals and tell France, yeah, sure, you know, we'll work together on nuclear technology, and there's no kind of sense of, well, actually, there are people will take advantage of these things and take advantage of you if they can. I mean, it's part of Mr. Flurry's drawn attention to this as part of the broken will of Britain and America. We lack the will to kind of stand up and be strong in an evil world. But so thank you very much for bringing us that story. Did you have any other stories from Asia to bring us?
Yes, I did. First up, a quick update on Russia's war against Ukraine. The big news this week is that Russia looks to be preparing a major intensification of its current offensive before the clock runs out on U.S. President Donald Trump's 50-day deadline. That 50 days was something that Mr. Trump announced on Monday. That's when he unveiled a new strategy in the Oval Office to supply Ukraine with advanced U.S. weapons, which will be paid for by America's European allies. And Mr. Trump said at that time that if Russia doesn't reach a ceasefire within 50 days, then he would place 100% secondary tariffs on countries that do business with Russia. So that would be a significant blow to Russia's oil industry in particular, and it could really dry up a great deal of the funding for the war. So it looks like Russian President Vladimir Putin right now is trying to just make that time count as much as he can. So Russia had already been in the midst of its summer offensive and had taken more than 400 square kilometers of Ukrainian territory during that time. But now this push is intensifying. There are reports that 160,000 Russian soldiers are now amassed, ready to add their force to what has already been raging. And unlike what we've seen in earlier chapters of the war, it looks like the Russians are now pushing kind of simultaneously all across the front line rather than focusing on certain areas. So Russia is scaling up the summer offensive, and it looks like they could soon close in on Pokrovsk and Kostyantynivka. Those are both logistical hubs. And Putin still has 45 days, as of today, remaining before President Trump's clock runs out. So if the Russians are able to maintain this current level and even intensify it before those 50 days run out, they could really capture some very important territory. And that could significantly improve Russia's negotiation position when this deadline is reached. It's also very possible that the Russians don't really care about President Trump's deadline, especially since he has extended those kinds of targets several times in the last few months. But in either case, the war seems to be heating up a great deal, and it could be just a very brutal summer, really, for both sides of this horrendous war. And then the final story that I wanted to mention was that for the first time in 5 years, the foreign ministers of India and China have met. And this looks to have been a major meeting. So this was Indian Foreign Minister S. Jaishankar and then Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. The meeting took place in Beijing. And we have to keep in mind that China and India are rivals. They have a shared border that they fight over periodically. Even as recently as 2020, that dispute blew up and dozens of soldiers were killed. India and China also compete against each other pretty viciously for influence in Southeast Asia and in the Indian Ocean and in other areas. So they are deeply mistrustful of each other. But now the foreign ministers have met and they worked out a plan to increase what they called pragmatic cooperation between India and China. And this included a mechanism for managing the border tensions. So this could be a notable step toward closer ties between China and India. And that's an outcome that the trumpet has long been expecting. So we will be keeping a close eye on this in the months ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. Thank you very much to all of our panelists this week. That is about all that we have time for. I'm trying to think of one piece of literature recommendation to leave you with. We've kind of been a bit all over the map today, but The United States and Britain in Prophecy is just always a great book to recommend. It really is the foundation to understanding Bible prophecy, the master key to unlock Bible prophecy. If you've not read that, I'd really encourage you to read that book. That's what you need to understand what is going on, not just in Britain, not just in the United States, but all around the world. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. and order that. We'll send it out to you. It's all free. This is not me trying to sell merchandise. We just want to get this truth out to the largest audience possible. Well, thank you so much for joining us. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. Please do like and subscribe on YouTube or Rumble. That helps us get the message out too. Thank you very much to George Haddad and Victor Granados for engineering and production. We'll be back on Wednesday, hopefully this time, with our review of the latest Trumpet print magazine. Until then, keep watching your world.